na katulor alif agaga. Famloy, ikaw na katulor alif agaga. Famloy, ikaw na katulor alif agaga.
Welcome to this, the 45th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. We open today with the next part of Teddy Roosevelt's book, Through the Brazilian Wilderness. Then we'll have a musical interlude, starring Marion Harris, and then we'll move on to the second part of our H.P. Lovecraft story, The Rats in the Walls. Let's get started. Through the Brazilian Wilderness, Part 13. We walked up the streets of Concepcion and interestedly looked at everything of interest. At the one-story houses, their windows covered with gratings of fretted ironwork, and their occasional open doors giving us glimpses into cool inner courtyards, with trees and flowers. At the two-wheel carts, drawn by mules or oxen. At an occasional rider with spurs on his bare feet and his big toe thrust into the small stirrup rings. At the little stores and the warehouses for mat and hides. Then we came to a pleasant little inn, kept by a Frenchman and his wife, of old Spanish style, with its patio or inner court, but as neat as an inn in Normandy or Brittany. We were sitting at coffee around a little table, when in came the colonel of the garrison, for Concepcion is the second city in Paraguay. He told me that they had prepared a reception for me. I was in my rough hunting clothes, but there was nothing to do but to accompany my kind hosts and trust to their good nature to pardon my shortcomings in the matter of dress. The colonel drove me about in a smart open carriage with two good horses and a liveried driver. It was a much more fashionable turnout than would be seen in any of our cities save the largest, and even in them probably not in the service of a public official. In all the South American countries, there is more pomp and ceremony in connection with public functions than with us, and at these functions the liveried servants, often with knee breeches and powdered hair, are like those seen at similar European functions. There is not the democratic simplicity which better suits our own habits of life and ways of thought. But the South Americans often surpass us, not merely in pomp and ceremony, but in what is of real importance, courtesy. In civility and courtesy, we can well afford to take lessons from them. We first visited the barracks, and saw the troops in the setting-up exercises, and inspected the arms, the artillery, the equipment. There was a German lieutenant with the Paraguayan officers, one of several German officers who are now engaged in helping the Paraguayans with their army. The equipments and arms were in good condition, the enlisted men, evidently fine material, and the officers were doing hard work. It is worthwhile for the anti-militarists to ponder the fact that in every South American country where a really efficient army is developed, the increase in military efficiency goes hand in hand with a decrease in the lawlessness and disorder, and a growing reluctance to settle internal disagreements by violence. They are introducing universal military service in Paraguay. The officers, many of whom have studied abroad, are growing to feel an increased esprit de corps, an increased pride in the army, and therefore a desire to see the army made the servant of the nation as a whole and not the tool of any faction or individual. If these feelings grow strong enough, they will be powerful factors in giving Paraguay what she most needs, freedom from revolutionary disturbance, and therefore the chance to achieve the material prosperity without which, as a basis, there can be no advance in other and more important matters. Then I was driven to the city hall, accompanied by the intendé, or mayor, a German long settled in the country, and one of the leading men of the city. There was a breakfast. When I had to speak, I impressed into my service, as interpreter, a young Paraguayan who was a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania. He was able to render into Spanish my ideas on such subjects as orderly liberty and the far-reaching mischief done by the revolutionary habit with clearness and vigour, because he thoroughly understood not only how I felt, but also the American way of looking at such things. My hosts were hospitality itself, and I enjoyed the unexpected greeting. We steamed on up the river. Now and then we passed another boat, a steamer, or to my surprise, perhaps a barkentine or schooner. The Paraguay is a highway of traffic. Once we passed a big beef canning factory. Ranches stood on either bank a few leagues apart, and we stopped at wood yards on the west bank. Indians worked around them. At one such yard the Indians were evidently part of the regular force. Their squaws were with them, cooking at queer open-air ovens. One small child had as pets a parrot and a young coati, a kind of long-nosed raccoon. Loading wood, the Indians stood in a line, tossing the logs from one to another. These Indians wore clothes. On this day, we got into the tropics. Even in the heat of the day, the deck was pleasant under the awnings. The sun rose and set in crimson splendour, and the nights, with the moon at full, were wonderful. At night, Orion blazed overhead, and the Southern Cross hung in the star-brilliant heavens behind us. But after the moon rose, the constellations paled, and clear in her light the tree-clad banks stood on either hand as we steamed steadily against the swirling current of the great river. At noon on the 12th, we were at the Brazilian boundary. On this day, we here and there came on low, conical hills close to the river. In places the palm groves broke through the belts of deciduous trees and stretched for a mile or so right along the river bank. At times we passed cattle on the banks or sandbars, followed by their herders or a handsome ranch house under a cluster of shady trees, some bearing a wealth of red and some a wealth of yellow blossoms. Or we saw a horse corral among the trees close to the brink, with the horses in it and a barefooted man in shirt and trousers leaning against the fence. Or a herd of cattle among the palms. Or a big tannery or factory or a little native hamlet came in sight. We stopped at one tannery. The owner was a Spaniard, the manager an Oriental, as he called himself, a Uruguayan of German parentage. The peons or workers who lived in a long line of wooden cabins back of the main building were mostly Paraguayans, with a few Brazilians and a dozen Germans and Argentine foremen. There were also some wild Indians, who were camped in the usual squalid fashion of Indians who are hangers-on round the white man, but have not yet adopted his ways. Most of the men were at work cutting wood for the tannery. The women and children were in camp. Some individuals of both sexes were naked to the waist. One little girl had a young ostrich as a pet. Waterfowl were plentiful. We saw large flocks of wild Muscovy ducks. Our tame birds came from this wild species, and its absurd misnaming dates back to the period when the turkey and guinea pig were misnamed in similar fashion. Our European forefathers, taking a large and hazy view of geography, and including Turkey, Guinea, India, and Muscovy, as places in which, in their capacity of being outlandish, could be comprehensively used as including America. The Muscovy ducks were very good eating. Darters and cormorants swarmed. They waddled on the sandbars in big flocks, and crowded the trees by the water's edge. Beautiful snow-white egrets also lit in the trees, often well back from the river. A full foliage tree of vivid green, its round surface crowded with these birds as if it had suddenly blossomed with huge white flowers, is a sight worth seeing. Here and there on the sandbars we saw huge jaribu stalks, and once a flock of white wood ibis among the trees on the bank. The musical interlude today is from Marion Harris, and is a 1918 track called Goodbye Alexander, Goodbye Honey Boy.
Alexander, goodbye. Lord, a parade is stopped. up and let me read my man. Alexander, honey, you all have certainly got some band. I've been marching right along with you ever since you left uptown, and I know your dogs are barking from the way you lay them down. But you certainly kept a strut, and I don't see how you can grin. Never mind, you tell your sweet puppies they're going to walk you right to Berlin. So go on across the ocean, cause these white folks know your worth, for there never was a color trader born upon this here earth. And they know that you'll die fighting, cause you're old Aunt Dinah's son. And the world can see you're fast black, and fast black will not run. You're from one race of people that will scrap and do it right. Cause that don't count the Irish, cause they don't do nothing else but fight. Now, Alexander, promise while you're across that pond, at night, don't care how hot you get, you keep your nightie on. Lord, there goes that beauty. Side, you hear that band? Honey, they're playing Dixie. Let him, Alexander. Goodbye, Alexander. Goodbye, honey boy. Dressed up in that uniform, you filled my heart with joy. You ain't born for moping. Boy, you sure can laugh. But you left that window open, and they got you in the trap. My loving for you, I'll be waiting like poor butterfly. So get busy with that gun and don't come back here till you won. Alexander, goodbye.
For the main feature today, we have a reading of the second part of a story written by Howard Lovecraft in 1923. The story is called The Rats in the Walls, and this second part is read for us by Paul.
Hello again, this is Paul, presenting to you today the second of two readings of H.P. Lovecraft's macabre tale of insanity, The Rats in the Walls. As you recall, last time we left off with the narrator of the story, the last of a dying household who has gone to his roots and rebuilt the family estate on a old and cracked barren ruin in the middle of England. We left off him coming suddenly awake to the terrifying sounds of rats scurrying all about him, waking from a terrible dream of a twilight grotto. The Rats in the Walls, Part 2. There was now no aurora to show the state of the Arras, the fallen section of which had been replaced, but I was not too frightened to switch on the light. As the bulbs leapt into radiance, I saw a hideous shaking all over the tapestry, causing the somewhat peculiar designs to execute a singular dance of death. This motion disappeared almost at once, and the sound with it. Springing out of bed, I poked at the arras with the long handle of a warming pan that rested near, and lifted one section to see what lay beneath. There was nothing but the patched stone wall, and even the cat had lost his tense realization of abnormal presences. When I examined the circular trap that had been placed in the room, I found all of the openings sprung, though no trace remained of what had been caught and had escaped. Further sleep was out of the question, so lighting a candle, I opened the door and went out into the gallery toward the stairs to my study. Midnight was following at my heels. Before we had reached the stone steps, however, the cat darted ahead of me and vanished down the ancient flight. As I descended the stairs myself, I became suddenly aware of sounds in the great room below, sounds of a nature which could not be mistaken. The oak-paneled walls were alive with rats, scampering and milling whilst midnight was racing about with the fury of a baffled hunter. Reaching the bottom, I switched on the light, which did not this time cause the noise to subside. The rats continued their riot, stampeding with such force and distinctness that I could finally assign to their motions a definite direction. These creatures, in numbers apparently inexhaustible, were engaged in one stupendous migration from inconceivable heights to some depth conceivably or inconceivably below. I now heard steps in the corridor, and in another moment, two servants pushed open the massive door. They were searching the house for some unknown source of disturbance, which had thrown all the cats into a snarling panic and caused them to plunge precipitately down several flights of stairs and squat, yowling, before the closed door of the subcellar. I asked them if they had heard the rats, but they replied in the negative. And when I turned to call their attention to the sounds in the panels, I realized that the noise had ceased. With the two men, I went down to the door of the subcellar, but found the cats already dispersed. Later, I resolved to explore the crypt below, but for the present, I merely made a round of the traps. All were sprung, yet all were tenantless, satisfying myself that no one had heard the rats save the felines and me. I sat in my study till morning, thinking profoundly and recalling every scrap of legend I had unearthed concerning the building I inhabited. I slept some in the forenoon, leaning back in one comfortable library chair which my medieval plan of furnishing could not banish. Later I telephoned to Captain Norris, who came over and helped me explore the subcellar. Absolutely nothing untoward was found, although we could not repress a thrill at the knowledge that this vault was built by Roman hands. Every low arch and massive pillar was Roman. Not the debased Romanesque of the bungling Saxons, but the severe and harmonious classicism of the age of the Caesars. Indeed, the walls abounded with inscriptions familiar to the antiquarians who had repeatedly explored the place. Things like, P. Getae Prop. Something, temp something, dona something, and el prieg versus or visa pontificatis. The references to Attis made me shiver, for I had read Catullus and knew something of the hideous rites of the Eastern god, whose worship was so mixed with that of Sibyl. Norris and I, by the light of lanterns, tried to interpret the odd and nearly effaced designs on certain irregularly rectangular blocks of stone generally held to be altars, but could make nothing of them. We remembered that one pattern, a sort of rayed sun, was held by students to imply a non-Roman origin, suggesting that these altars had merely been adopted by the Roman priests for some older and perhaps aboriginal temple on the same site. On one of these blocks were some brown stains which made me wonder. The largest, in the center of the room, had certain features on the upper surface which indicated its connection with fire, probably burnt offerings. Such were the sights in that crypt before whose door the cats howled, and where Norris and I now determined to pass the night. Couches were brought down by the servants, who were told not to mind any nocturnal actions of the cats, and midnight was admitted as much for help as for companionship. We decided to keep the great oak door, a modern replica with slits for ventilation, tightly closed, and with this attended to, we retired with lanterns still burning to await whatever might occur. The vault was very deep in the foundations of the priory, and undoubtedly far down on the face of the beetling limestone cliff overlooking the waste valley. That it had been the goal of the scuffling and unexplainable rats I could not doubt, though why I could not tell. As we lay there expectantly, I found my vigil occasionally mixed with the half-formed dreams from which the uneasy motions of the cat across my feet would rouse me. These dreams were not wholesome, but horrible, like the one I had had the night before. I saw again the twilight grotto, and the swineherd with his unmentionable fungous beasts wallowing in filth. And as I looked at these things, they seemed nearer and more distinct, so distinct that I could almost observe their features. Then I did observe the flabby features of one of them, and awakened with such a scream that midnight started up, whilst Captain Norris, who had not slept, laughed considerably. Norreys might have laughed more, or perhaps less, had he known what it was that made me scream, but I did not remember myself till later. Ultimate horror often paralyzes memory in a merciful way. Norreys waked me when the phenomena began. Out of the same frightful dream, I was called by his gentle shaking and his urging to listen to the cats. Indeed, there was much to listen to, for beyond the closed door at the head of the stone steps was a veritable nightmare of feline yelling and clawing, whilst Midnight, unmindful of his kindred outside, was running excitedly round the bare stone walls, in which I had heard the same babble of scurrying rats that had troubled me the night before. An acute terror now rose within me, for here were anomalies which nothing normal could well explain. These rats, if not the creatures of madness which I shared with the cats alone, must be burrowing and sliding in Roman walls I had thought to be solid limestone blocks. Unless perhaps the action of water through more than 17 centuries had eaten winding tunnels which rodent bodies had worn clear and ample. But even so, the spectral horror was no less, for if these were living vermin, why did not Norreys hear their disgusting commotion? Why did he urge me to watch Midnight and listen to the cats outside, and why did he guess wildly and vaguely at what could have aroused them? By the time I had managed to tell him, as rationally as I could, what I thought I was hearing, my ears gave me the last fading impression of scurrying, which had retreated still downward, far underneath this deepest of subcellars, till it seemed as if the whole cliff below were riddled with questing rats. Norreys was not as skeptical as I had anticipated, but instead seemed profoundly moved. He motioned to me to notice that the cats at the door had ceased their clamor as if giving up the rats for lost, while Midnight had a burst of renewed relentlessness and was clawing frenetically at around the bottom of the large stone altar in the center of the room, which was nearer Norreys' couch than mine. My fear of the unknown was at this point very great. Something astounding had occurred, and I saw that Captain Norreys, a younger, stouter, and presumably more naturally materialistic man, was affected fully as much as myself, perhaps because of his lifelong and intimate familiarity with local legend. We could for the moment do nothing but watch the old black cat as he pawed with decreasing fervor at the base of the altar, occasionally looking up and mewing to me in that persuasive manner which he had used when he wished me to perform some favor for him. Norreys now took a lantern close to the altar and examined the place where Midnight was pawing, silently kneeling and scraping away the lichens of centuries which joined the massive pre-Roman block to the tessellated floor. He did not find anything and was about to abandon his efforts when I noticed a trivial circumstance which made me shudder, even though it implied nothing more than I had already imagined. I told him of it, and we both looked at its almost imperceptible manifestation with a fixedness of fascinated discovery and acknowledgement. It was only this, that the flame of the lantern set down near the altar was slightly but certainly flickering from a draft of air which it had not before received, and which came indubitably from the crevice between floor and altar where Norreys was scraping away the lichens. We spent the rest of the night in the brilliantly lighted study, nervously discussing what we should do next. The discovery that some vault, deeper than the deepest known masonry of the Romans, underlay this accursed pile, some vault unsuspected by the curious antiquarians of three centuries, would have been sufficient to excite us without any background of the sinister. As it was, the fascination became twofold, and we paused in doubt whether to abandon our search and quit the priory forever in superstitious caution, or to gratify our sense of adventure and brave whatever horrors might await us in the unknown depths. By morning, we had compromised and decided to go to London to gather a group of archaeologists and scientific men fit to cope with the mystery. It should be mentioned that before leaving the subcellar, we had vainly tried to move the central altar, which we now recognized as the gate to a new pit of nameless fear. What secret would open the gate? Wiser men than we would have to find. During many days in London, Captain Norreys and I presented our facts, conjectures, and legendary anecdotes to five eminent authorities, all men who could be trusted to respect any family disclosures which future explorations might develop. We found most of them little disposed to scoff, but instead intensely interested and sincerely sympathetic. It is hardly necessary to name them all, but I may say that they included Sir William Brinton, whose excavations in the Troad excited most of the world in their day. As we all took the train for Anchester, I felt myself poised on the brink of frightful revelations, a sensation symbolized by the air of mourning among the many Americans at the unexpected death of the president on the other side of the world. On the evening of 7 August, we reached Exham Priory, where the servants assured me that nothing unusual had occurred. The cats, even old Midnight, had been perfectly placid, and not a trap in the house had been sprung. We were to begin exploring on the following day, awaiting which I assigned well-appointed rooms to all my guests. I myself retired to my own tower chamber, with Midnight across my feet. Sleep came quickly, but hideous dreams assailed me. There was a vision of a Roman feast like that of Trimalchio, with a horror in a covered platter. Then came that damnable, reoccurring thing about the swineherd and his filthy drove in the twilight grotto. Yet when I awoke, it was full daylight, with normal sounds in the house below. The rats, living or spectral, had not troubled me, and Midnight was still quietly asleep. On going down, I found that the same tranquility had prevailed elsewhere, a condition which one of the assembled servants, a fellow named Thornton, devoted to the psychic, rather absurdly laid to the fact that I had now been shown the thing which certain forces had wished to show me. All was now ready, and at 11 a.m. our entire group of 7 men, bearing powerful electric searchlights and implements of excavation, went down to the sub-cellar and bolted the door behind us. Midnight was with us, for the investigators found no occasion to despise his excitability, and were indeed anxious that he be present in case of obscure rodent manifestations. We noted the Roman inscriptions and unknown altar designs only briefly, for 3 of the servants had already seen them, and all knew their characteristics. Prime attention was paid to the momentous central altar, and within an hour Sir William Brinton had caused it to tilt backward, balanced by some unknown species of counterweight. There now lay revealed such a horror as would have overwhelmed us had we not been prepared. Through a nearly square opening in the tiled floor, sprawling on a flight of stone steps so prodigiously worn that it was little more than an inclined plane at the center, was a ghastly array of human and semi-human bones. Those which retained their collocation as skeletons showed attitudes of panic fear, and over all were the marks of rodent gnawing. The skulls denoted nothing short of utter idiocy, cretinism, or primitive semi-apedom. Above the hellishly littered steps arched a descending passageway seemingly chiseled from the solid rock and conducting a current of air. This current was not a sudden and noxious rush as from a closed vault, but a cool breeze with something of freshness in it. We did not pause long, but shiveringly began to clear a passage down the steps. It was then that Sir William examined the hewn walls, made the odd observation that the passage, according to the direction of the strokes, must have been chiseled from beneath. I must be very deliberate now and choose my words. After plowing down a few steps amidst the gnawing bones, we saw that there was a light ahead, not a mystic phosphorescence, but a filtered daylight which could not come except from unknown fissures in the cliff that overlooked the waste valley. That such fissures had escaped notice from outside was hardly remarkable, for not only is the valley wholly uninhabited, but the cliff is so high and beetling that only an aeronaut could study its face in detail. A few steps more and our breasts were literally snatched from us by what we saw, so literally that Thornton, the psychic investigator, actually fainted in the arms of the dazed men who stood behind him. Norris, his plump face utterly white and flabby, simply cried out inarticulately, whilst I think what I did was gasp or hiss and cover my eyes. The man behind me, the only one of the party older than I, Crook the Hackney, my God, in the most cracked voice I ever heard. Of 7 cultivated men, only Sir William Brinton retained his composure, a thing the more to his credit because he led the party and must have seen the sight first. It was a twilit grotto of enormous height, stretching away farther than the eye could see, a subterraneous world of limitless mystery and horrible suggestion. There were buildings and other architectural remains. In one terrifying glance, I saw a weird pattern of tumuli, a savage circle of monoliths, a low-domed Roman ruin, a sprawling Saxon pile, and an early English edifice of wood, but all these were dwarfed by the ghoulish spectacle presented by the general surface of the ground. For yards about the steps extended an insane tangle of human bones, or bones at least as human as those on the steps. Like a foamy sea they stretched, some fallen apart, but others wholly or partially articulated as skeletons. These later variably in postures of demonic frenzy, either fighting off some menace or clutching other forms with cannibal intent. When Dr. Trask, the anthropologist, stopped to classify the skulls, he found a degraded mixture which utterly baffled him. They were mostly lower than the Piltdown man in the scale of evolution, but in every case definitely human. Many were of higher grade, and a very few of the skulls were of supremely and sensitively developed types. All the bones were gnawed, mostly by rats, but somewhat by others of the half-human drove. Mixed with them were many tiny bones of rats, fallen members of the lethal army which closed the ancient epoch. I wonder that any man among us lived and kept his sanity through that hideous day of discovery. Not Hoffman, nor Huysmans, could conceive a scene more wildly incredible, more frenetically repellent, or more gothically grotesque than the twilight grotto through which we 7 staggered, each stumbling on revelation after revelation, and trying to keep for once from thinking of the events which must have taken place there 300, or 1,000, or 2,000, or 10,000 years ago. It was the antechamber of hell, and poor Thornton fainted again when Trask told him that some of the skeleton things must have been descended as quadrupeds through the last 20 or more generations. Horror piled on horror as we began to interpret the architectural remains. The quadruped things, with their occasional recruits from the biped class, had been kept in stone pens, out of which they must have broken in their last delirium of hunger or rat fear. There had been great herds of them, evidently fattened on the coarse vegetables whose remains could be found as a sort of poisonous ensilage at the bottom of the huge stone bins older than Rome. I knew now why my ancestors had had such excessive gardens. Would to heaven I could forget. The purpose of the herds I did not have to ask. Sir William, standing with his searchlight in the Roman ruin, translated aloud the most shocking ritual I have ever known, and told of the diet of the antediluvian cult, which the priests of Sybil found and mingled with their own. Norreys, used as he was to the trenches, could not walk straight when he came out of the English building. It was a butcher shop and kitchen. He had expected that, but it was too much to see familiar English implements in such a place, and to read familiar English graffiti there. Some as recent as 1610. I could not go in that building whose demon activities were stopped only by the dagger of my ancestor Walter de la Pore. What I did venture to enter was the low Saxon building whose oaken door had fallen, and there I found a terrible row of 10 stone cells with rusty bars. 3 had tenants, all skeletons of high grade, and on the bony forefinger of one I found a seal ring with my own coat of arms. Sir William found a vault with far older cells below the Roman chapel, but these cells were empty. Below them was a low crypt with cases of formerly arranged bones, some of them bearing terrible parallel inscriptions carved in Latin, Greek, and the tongue of Phrygia. Meanwhile, Dr. Trask had opened one of the prehistoric tumuli and brought to light skulls which were slightly more human than a gorilla's and which bore indescribable ideographic carvings. Through all of this horror, my cat stalked unperturbed. Once I saw him monstrously perched atop a mountain of bones, and wondered at the secrets that might lie behind his yellow eyes. Having grasped to some slight degree the frightful revelations of this twilight area, an area so hideously foreshadowed by my recurrent dream, we turned to that apparent boundless depth of midnight cavern where no ray of light from the cliff could penetrate. We shall never know what sightless Stygian worlds yawn beyond the little distance we went, for it was decided that such secrets are not good for mankind. But there was plenty to engross us close to hand, for we had not gone far before the searchlight showed that accursed infinity of pits in which the rats had feasted, and whose sudden lack of replenishment had driven the ravenous rodent army first to turn on the living herds of starving things, and then to burst forth from the priory in that historic orgy of devastation which the peasants will never forget. God! Those carrion black pits of sawed, picked bones and open skulls. Those nightmare chasms choked with the pithic anthropoid Celtic, Roman, and English bones of countless unhallowed centuries. Some of them were full, and none can say how deep they had once been. Others were still bottomless to our searchlights and peopled by unnameable fancies. What I thought of the hapless rats that stumbled into such traps amidst the blackness of their quests in this grisly Tartarus. Once my foot slipped near a horribly yawning brink, and I had a moment of ecstatic fear. I must have been musing a long time, for I could not see any of the party but plump Captain Norreys. Then there came a sound from that inky, bottomless, farther distance that I thought I knew, and I saw my old black cat dart past me like a winged Egyptian god straight into the illimitable gulf of the unknown. But I was not far behind, for there was no doubt after another second it was the eldritch scurrying of those fiend-born rats, always questing for new horrors and determined to lead me on even unto those grinning caverns of Earth's center where Narlathotep the mad faceless god howls blindly in the darkness to the piping of two amorphous idiot flute players. My searchlight expired, but still I ran. I heard voices and yowls and echoes, but above all there gently rose that impious, insidious scurrying, gently rising, rising as a stiff, bloated corpse rises gently above an oily river that flows under the endless onyx bridges to a black, putrid sea. Something bumped into me, something soft and plump. It must have been the rats, the vicious, gelatinous, ravenous army that feast on the dead and the living. Why should rats eat Adelapore as Adelapore eats forbidden things? The war ain't my boy, damn them all. And the Yanks ate Carfax with flames and burnt Grandsire Adelapore and the secret. No. No, I tell you, I am not that demon swineherd in the Twilight Grotto. It was not Edward Norrie's fat face on that flabby fungus thing. Who says I am Adelapore? He lived, but my boy died. Shall Norreys hold the land of Adelapore? It's voodoo, I tell you, that spotted snake. Curse you, Thornton, I'll teach you to faint at what my family do. It's blood, thou stinkard. I'll learn ye how to gust. Wold ye swink me thinky-wise. Magna mater, atis dia acti agnum ad adawan. Agus bas adanat ort. Danas dala or agus liat anguan jatjat. This is what they say I said. When they found me in that blackness after 3 hours, found me crouching in the blackness over the plump, half-eaten body of Captain Norreys, with my own cat leaping and tearing at my throat. Now they have blown up Exham Priory, taken my midnight away from me, and shut me into this barred room at Hanwell. With fear whispers about my heredity and experience, Thornton is in the next room, but they prevent me from talking to him. They are trying to suppress most of the facts concerning the priory. When I speak of poor Norreys, they accuse me of this hideous thing. But they must know that I did not do it. They must know it was the rats, the slithering, scurrying rats whose scampering will never let me sleep. the demon rats that race behind the padding in this room and beckon me down to greater horrors than I have ever known. The rats they can never hear. The rats. The rats in the walls. Thank you for listening. That brings us to a close for H.P. Lovecraft's The Rats in the Walls. One of the things that I've always found most intriguing about this story is the interplay of the rats and the cats. Rats and cats, obviously, animalistically opposite. But taking that in context with the insanity that comes about via the rats, the madness that envelops the main character, our narrator, is of key interest to me. I've always found that in H.P. Lovecraft's mythology that cats were almost on par with human beings. I mean, they had speech, they had society, they had gods, they had everything that we bring to the table as far as what it is to be an elevated animal, if you will. And one interesting point that I think is the most important in this context is the goings-on of Delaporte's ancient family. What were they doing? Were they holding the rats at bay? Were they using the rats as collateral? You know, do what we want, or we're going to unleash the rats, or were they cannibals? Were they stealing the peasantry's children and the peasantry themselves for their cannibalistic rites? You know, what was actually going on there? Who can really say? But perhaps the cats in their long memory could never forgive the investment that this family had given into such an abomination, something so antithetical to a cat. You know, this invasion of rats probably did not go unheard of or unseen in the world of cats. Perhaps after 3 centuries, the cats can finally sleep.
That's all for today. Except to say a special thank you to Victor Valdez, who has kindly given permission to use his music from the Symbol Project in this show. You heard it in the opening credits. I'm planning on letting you hear more of this music in the not-too-distant future, so keep listening for that. Remember also that I'm on the lookout for more stories. If you've written a creepy horror story set in or around the 1920s, or a story containing elements of the Cthulhu mythos set anywhen, then please get in touch and let's see if we can get your story onto this podcast. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk